Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll discuss the election and your mental health. Some people are very stressed about the presidential race. We'll hear from a health reporter with some tips to unwind a bit. There are also races beyond just the one for president. Here in Illinois, Democrats hope to expand their supermajority in the General Assembly. We'll get some details. We'll also hear from two people on different sides of the political spectrum about how they consume news and what they may have in common. The director of a new film on former Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger joins us to discuss the project. School shootings have become too common. A superintendent who has studied the issue gives his thoughts. And we'll learn about an opportunity for college students who want to make a podcast. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. We're glad to have you along on Statewide this week. Ahead this hour, we'll talk about the upcoming election and the stress it brings for many people. But first, research indicates there are almost 500,000 acts of violence in America's schools every year. Steve Webb is superintendent of the Gorville School District in Southern Illinois and founder of the Safe Schools System. He's also the author of the book Education in a Violent World. Brad Palmer spoke with Webb, who attributes the reasons for violence, including school shootings, to the unmonitored, unregulated access young people have on the internet, and parents and school leaders being unable to connect to the world children are growing up in.
I visited these communities that had these tragedies. I found there was always a social media presence, some type of social media hints that there was a downward spiral going on in these children, and we just didn't recognize it, or we just ignored it. So what I want people to understand is while we hear about these tragedies and we continually hear about all of the things that we could have possibly known to prevent these things, we're not learning from our mistakes. It continually happens. So what I want people to understand is when you get older and you get disconnected from these new generations, and every generation does that, every generation believes that the next one, you know, what they're into is it just doesn't make sense to them. Once you disconnect from that system, you disconnect from all of those hints that could help prevent these terrible tragedies.
So how do you go about doing that? Does this involve monitoring? Do we have to worry about privacy issues here or anything like that?
Well, there are monitoring services that can help us. What it boils down to is communication. We've got to do a better job of communicating with our youth and understanding this world that they're growing up in. And we've got to do a better job of connecting those people that are coming into the workforce. In 2025, 75% of educators are going to be millennials who grew up with social media. When I wrote my book, I was writing it based on, I thought I was pretty knowledgeable about the world, and come to find out, I wasn't. I disconnected myself because I didn't want to know about it. Now I'm totally immersing myself in it so I can help others.
How have you been doing that? How do you go about doing that?
Every time there's a tragedy and it's connected to a social media area, I download it, I go to it, I research it, and I use it in my next speech. And sometimes I use the same ones over and over again because we're not learning our lessons. When I hear something new, like Yubo or Tor or some of these areas like 4chan, that they are even live streaming some of these shootings, I go research it so I can tell others, hey, this thing is out there. Know that it's out there. Here's some monitoring things that you can do to make sure it's not occurring in your community. And just be aware that it's there, because if you hear that in a conversation, maybe then you will understand there may be some extremism going on.
Have you found some common themes that people need to be aware of or be looking for that may lead to something much bigger and more tragic?
Yeah, many of the common themes are they're actually saying that they're going to be a famous school shooter. They're saying that they're suicidal. They're saying that they're in this state of depression, and they're telling people, and they're just dismissing it. They're not understanding it, that it's a true threat, and so they up the ante. They take it to a little bit more extreme level because they're trying to get a reaction to you, whether they're trying to get more follows, more likes, more loves, whatever you call it in social media. They're taking it to another extreme, and many times that's leading to a very extreme situation. Now, let's not forget, the most guns that we take off children in America, they're bringing for protection from the to and from schools. That's the most guns that are coming into our schools, are those that are there for protection. But what we hear about are these mass shootings, and we have to do a better job at understanding these mass shootings was a process It was a 93% of them are planned, and it was a process, and they let somebody know in social media. Why aren't they telling us?
What role do these students, say, friends or other followers or people who are on these sites with them, what role would you like to see them play as far as maybe alerting parents and school officials that, hey, someone's talking about, you know, doing conducting a school shooting or harming people?
So we've had several stopped. I mean, this happens on an everyday basis, some type of threat, and somebody let somebody in authority know, and they were able to stop it. What I would like to see is this connection part of what we are as educators, as community leaders, as police officers, as whoever is trying to work with children and work with families, better understand the world that they're growing up in and understand that what you might learn today is going to change tomorrow. You have to continually have what I call a learner's mindset to be able to traverse this new world, or you'll be completely disconnected from it and nobody will want to talk to you about it at all. Once you build that connection, you build that communication stream to somebody that can help.
What do you say to maybe some skeptics who say, once a person has this in their mind, no matter what you do or say to them, it may change what they're going to try to do? How do you go about cutting it off before they get to the point where they're going to actually follow through with the threat?
Well, that's a great question, and you know, you can. I'm not a counselor. I've been an administrator for over 3 decades, and I've seen kids come and go that have had troubles at homes, that have had terrible domestic issues, that have had terrible upbringings to that point, not turn into a murderer. And then I go to some of these communities where these kids were from a middle income family or a solid family. And all of a sudden, for whatever reason, they started in this social media realm of 5-second snippets that had got them into an extreme mode of, I want to be famous. And so there is what I tell people in each one of my presentations, every one of my trainings, there is no such thing as norm referenced, like determining what normal is. These kids all have such different experiences than we did growing up. Where we educated the masses, now they're getting educated on their smartphones to the tune of their research suggests they search their smartphone over 100 times a day. That's what's teaching our kids. We need to understand that and use that to be able to determine which direction they're headed in.
Okay. Now, I know there are some schools across the country, even some in our region, who have instituted a policy where students are not allowed on their phones during the school day. Is that a step in the right direction?
Yes. I mean, that's a common policy. And the more we can maybe get them off of that addiction of being on their phone, the better off it is to build their capacity of wanting to retain information. Cell phones and having that Siri and having that Google readily at your fingertips, you don't have to build capacity to maintain information because you can just ask and it'll tell you. Same thing with this new AI, ChatGPT. It'll tell you what you need to know. Well, what we try to do in schools is try to build that capacity for learning, but we also need to build it for us. I mean, once you get to be an adult, you get to be a teacher, you see some of these things happen. We start getting numb from some of that, and that's the culture of complacency, and that's where I was headed before I started researching this in depth, and I want to make sure other people understand I saw that in every single tragedy. We just didn't want to connect with this world.
Can you elaborate on how parents can help in this aspect? Obviously, kids are on their phones a lot at home. How do parents go about keeping track and as you mentioned, learning where their kids are going, this language that they may have online?
Sure. Well, parents need to fully understand that they are probably the owner of that phone. They probably bought that phone. They gave it to the child. They are still the owner. There is no expectation of privacy for that child. You need to have full control of what they can download, what apps that are there. And I'll tell you, I say this in a lot of news services for parents to understand, if there are 3 calculators on that phone, more than likely they're not using 3 calculators. More than likely there's things called vaults. Vaults are areas where it looks like a normal app, but once you put in a code, it opens it up to the world that they're trying to hide from you. Those things are rampant in America. America today, particularly for children who are trying to hide the fact that they're on some of these social media areas, hide the pictures that they're sending. Parents need to go to that phone, make sure they control the downloads to it, and then check everything that's on that phone on a regular basis and talk to your children.
Steve, where can parents, school administrators, is there a place, say, online, or where would you direct people to go to try and learn more about how to take some of these steps that you talk about?
Sure. Well, there are some good monitoring apps out there that they can go take a look at, and they'll kind of highlight some of the areas that they can monitor for you. Bark is one of them that is widely used for parents. 360 is another one that is widely used. But just know there are workarounds on those things. There are things that kids can download to their phones to be able to work around some of your safeguards. But I would take them to just simple Google searches on monitoring my child's phone and start looking up all of those different ways that they can do that, and then have that discussion with that child, first of all. I mean, they can call me, and they can contact me through my website, drstevewebb.com, and I'm just going to direct them to all of the information that's out there about this situation and the fact that they can research it themselves. They just need to know that there is an ugly world out there, and they need to be prepared to talk to their child about it. You know, this is not a revolution. It's a revelation. It's a fact of that I didn't grow up in the social media age, and I was trying my best to not be in the social media age, and that caused a disconnection. And I think we see that in each generation. If there was any great message I would put out there, it would be, I understand. I understand I've got grandchildren now. I worry about the experiences that they're going to have, but just know they're going to have different experiences than you do. Be a part of those experiences.
Steve Webb is superintendent of the Gorville School District in Southern Illinois. He's founder of the Safe School System. He's also author of the book, Education in a Violent World. Well, the NPR College Podcast Challenge is back for its fourth year, an opportunity for college students to have their voice and their story reach the NPR audience and beyond. And it comes with a $5,000 cash prize. To learn more, Adeline Moy spoke with NPR's Steve Drummond and Janet Ujong Lee.
So the two of you oversee NPR's annual College Podcast Challenge, which is now open for submissions. That is super exciting. To start, can you give us a bit of an overview? What's this podcast challenge all about, and what kinds of entries are you looking for?
Sure. This is the fourth year of the College Podcast Challenge, and it grew out of our student podcast challenge for younger students, which we've been doing for 6 years now. We had great success with students in grades 5 through 12, and every year we kept hearing, hey, what about us? What about college students? So we've now opened that contest up, and we're having a lot of fun. We've had many great entries. We've had students from all 50 states, from community colleges and four-year schools and big giant universities. And the fun part of it is we get very personal and very rich storytelling from these students.
It sounds like there is a lot of variety here. Can you tell us a little bit about what makes a winning entry? Can you give us some examples?
Yeah. So to talk about our most recent winner from the 2024 contest, it was a student from Miami-Dade College named Michael Vargas Arango, and he made a very personal story podcast about growing up with a rare mental health condition called a schizoaffective disorder. So he went about and interviewed everyone from like experts, then also students on his own campus who responded to him about how they felt about knowing that there's someone with his condition on his campus, and kind of debunked what are sort of misconceptions around mental illness. And that one, I would say, is a really good example of kind of doing a nice like personal storytelling that's like also really well reported, but with a great use of sound. I think to kind of hit some categories, that's also in our judging manual, we look for a really good story and really good structure. And then there's production. So I would say just like focus on finding whatever story that you're passionate about and want to talk about, and kind of having a good outline to work with and not being too scared, even if you're a little new to audio editing and all that.
I'd also like to ask you about one particular finalist from last year, Brandon Condritz. He's from Illinois, and he submitted a podcast titled The Day I Ditched My Devices. His piece explored what it's like to spend a day completely unplugged from technology. Was there anything in particular that stood out to you about his story?
I mean, Steve and I both love that one. I think I think that's a good example of one that instantly made us smile. I think it was really nicely put together with just like voice memos weaved in with a lot of good scene tape.
Above all, the biggest challenge was not being able to listen to music, especially in the gym.
So that 20-minute run and then my ab circuit that I did was really strange. Without music, the sounds of my feet thumping the treadmill was really strange.
And walking through campus.
I left that class and I had to do the 20-minute walk back down south. And that was weird because usually I listen to my music while I'm walking.
So something that everyone listening could relate to, but just weaving that together in kind of day in the life format, that was really nicely done.
So what advice would you give to someone who doesn't have a lot of experience but is looking to enter?
Go for it. That's my advice. Adeline, you're talking into a microphone right now. It doesn't take much more than that. I teach podcasting at the University of Maryland, and I tell my students, you can do this with nothing more than a smartphone and a laptop computer and some basic free software like Audacity or something like that. You can use the voice memo recording on your phone. And many, many of these are students who just have a story to tell. We've had the full range. We get students who are journalism students or who are submitting the podcast that they produce for their podcasting class. But frankly, a lot of our winners and a lot of our finalists have been students who are just doing this on their own kind of as a personal project. So I would encourage anybody who thinks they might want to give it a try to go for it and see what happens.
Jana Ujong Lee and Steve Drummond oversee NPR's College Podcast Challenge. Again, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Adeline. And we'll be looking for your podcast entry.
All right. I will see if I can get that in. Deadline is January, I think, 10th. I already looked at it.
Yeah, so you have plenty of time, Adeline.
All right. Sounds great. Again, thank you guys so much for being here.
Great talking with you.
Amazing talking with you. Thank you.
That's NPR's Steve Drummond and Janet Ujong Lee. And they spoke with Adeline Moy. You can find out more information about the NPR College Podcast Challenge. We have a link at our statewide show page. There's more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. And welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. President Biden issued an apology last month for a federal policy of forcibly separating Native children from their parents and sending them to boarding schools where they endured abuse and some died. Joseph Rupnick is chair of Illinois' federally recognized tribe, the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation. He told reporter Emily Hayes that after the boarding schools, only 5 of the 4,500 members of the band speak Potawatomi as a first language.
What has been the experience of people in your nation with boarding schools?
Start off with my mom, who was 3 years old when she was first taken to attend boarding school, and they shipped her to Marty, South Dakota. So when the agents came down, my grandparents tried to say she's not old enough. They said, no, she's plenty old. And they took her to South Dakota. Of course, our reservation is in Kansas.
Can you tell me more about how you think the boarding schools affected your mom?
She never talked Indian again. And I remember when I was a little kid, my grandparents was talking Indian to us. And then she got mad at them. And then part of that was because she says, well, I don't want these kids to grow up with broken English and, you know, and having, you know, somebody abuse them like I was. That was a piece of us that was taken away that we'll never be able to get back.
What do you think would be a true apology then for the U.S. government doing the boarding schools?
While apologies are good, that does not really translate into action. And right now, tribes have to compete against each other for grant dollars for language revitalization. I said, if the government truly wanted to make that first step, then the ultimate goal should be that no tribe should ever have to pay for language revitalization. That should be an amount that Congress sets aside that is direct directly paid to the tribe for those language programs.
So do you have any language revitalization programs right now?
Yes, we do.
What does that look like?
They're doing a really good job. They're starting to teach a lot of the youth. They also partner with our local school district where they're able to go in and teach the language in school, and it's open to anybody. On top of that, you know, we're working towards making our language instructors certified so that those kids that do participate in that language program in school can use that as credits for secondary education.
What would you say is your next step in language revitalization?
Same as it has been since I've been in office. Of course, we fund our language program, try to get as many folks involved in it as we can. So as a government, we're making sure that it's there, it's available, and that they have the necessary funds to continue the program.
Education reporter Emily Hayes speaking with Joseph Rupnick, chair of Illinois' federally recognized tribe, the Prairie Band Potawatomi Nation. Well, it's no secret the Democratic Party holds a great deal of political power in Illinois. Democrats have a stronghold in every statewide constitutional office, from the governor to the comptroller. And the House and Senate at the Capitol are overwhelmingly blue. Every seat in the Illinois State House of Representatives is up for election this year. And as November 5th draws near, Democratic leaders are hoping to not only hold on to their supermajority, but grow it. Mawa Iqbal reports.
Of 118 total House seats in Springfield, Democrats currently hold 78 of them. That's two-thirds of the House. But even with that comfortable margin, the Democratic Party of Illinois wants even more. It's looking to expand its power this election. Lisa Hernandez is chair of the state Democratic Party.
The momentum, the excitement, the kind of feedback I'm getting, I can't help it, but tell you that it is... It looks good in Illinois.
Hernandez has served in the Illinois House as a state representative for almost two decades. She believes the Illinois Republicans have fallen out of touch with voters. And so Democrats are eyeing six Republican-held House seats across the state in the hopes of flipping them blue this November.
We are about keeping and preserving our values, our Democratic values. I mean, the fight is there to... when it comes to women's rights, working families.
One of the six seats Democrats hope to flip is the 114th District, which covers East St. Louis and some of the rural areas surrounding it. It's currently held by Republican Kevin Schmidt. His challenger, Latoya Greenwood, previously held that seat for 6 years. She lost to Schmidt in 2022 by more than 2,000 votes.
I remember just trying to understand actually what happened. That next day, just trying to figure out, where did I go wrong?
Greenwood says she was caught off guard because it's been a Democratic area for many years. And East St. Louis's population is 95% Black. Greenwood, who is Black and from East St. Louis, says Schmidt just doesn't understand the community.
He has not represented me. In 2 years, he hasn't voted for a budget that would bring resources to my community or the Metro East area.
Schmidt is a white chiropractor from Millstadt, a village of about 4,000 people, 13 miles south of East St. Louis. He says he's not worried about losing to Greenwood.
She was in office, I believe, for three terms and never lifted a finger as far as listening to constituents in the entire district.
But Schmidt has his work cut out for him to get reelected. Greenwood has a massive fundraising advantage over Schmidt. This is a disadvantage Minority Leader of the House, Tony McCombie, says is true for most Republicans in down-ballot races across Illinois.
We have lost a lot of our big donors. You know, we're not going to get a late surprise here in October of $1 million donor.
McCombie says her party faces an uphill battle in the quest to get more seats.
We're not going to say we're going to become the majority party. We're not going to say we're going to flip 10 seats. We're saying we're going to do this one cycle at a time, bit by bit, and get us closer to the map in the 10-year time.
So while the Democrats are targeting six incumbent Republicans for defeat next month and expand their supermajority even more, the Illinois GOP is taking the long view, trying to inch its way back to power. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Big Pharma is throwing a lot of campaign money at Illinois congressional members as we approach the election. All 17 Illinois incumbents are up for re-election, and some have received thousands in contributions from pharmaceutical companies like Pfizer. The Chicago Sun-Times reporter Robert Hergeth has been following the money. He spoke about it with Mary Dixon.
So what did you find looking at all of these campaign contributions?
Well, Big Pharma is donating big to at least a few members of the Illinois congressional delegation this election cycle.
And who are they? Why are they getting this money? Is it just because they're nice?
Perhaps. So there are 17 members of the House of Representatives from Illinois, and three of them, really the pharma money is centered on. And just my research looking at FEC records, which Federal Election Commission records, shows that the three of them collectively have received over $300,000 over the past this year and last year. And they share something in that they all three sit on influential House committees that deal with pharma legislation.
And who are these Congress members from Illinois?
It's U.S. Rep. Brad Schneider, Robin Kelly, and Darren LaHood, the first two being Democrats, LaHood being a Republican.
How much cash did they splash around Illinois?
Well, the three members of Congress that I really centered on, it was over $300,000 collectively, so about 100 grand each over the past, this year and this past year. And then they're collectively for the others, it was about 100,000 together. So that gives some perspective on how much money is centered on these three members who sit on these two very influential committees in the House that deal with drug prices and drug regulations.
So what do the politicians who've gotten the money, what do they have to say?
The members of Congress who receive this say that's not true, or at least to the extent that they talk to me. Darren LaHood's office would not talk, but Robin Kelly and Brad Schneider's office, they're press people, said that they are advocates for the public and that their voting records demonstrate that.
Again, we're in election season. People are early voting already. Why do you think it's important for voters to know about this?
I think it's important for voters to know about any special interest that seeks to influence or impact decision making or politics. And there are few more lucrative special interests than Big Pharma. I'm not sure there's another special interest that impacts people's lives as much. And so I think that it's just important for people to realize that, and also to realize that some of these companies that are giving to members of Congress or prospective members of Congress, especially from Illinois, they also have been implicated in the opioid crisis that's killed more than 500,000 Americans over the past 20 years or so from overdose deaths, and that the opioid crisis is not over. Last number I saw was, I believe, more than 80,000 people in the U.S. This is a tragedy. And these companies, some of these companies, are blamed for it.
Robert Hergeth is a reporter at the Sun-Times, and you can read his full report at suntimes.com. Thanks for being with us today, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
A new documentary called The Last Republican follows conservative Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger as he tries to hold Donald Trump accountable for the January 6th Capitol riots.
It's not about a political view. It's about what it is to turn against everything you've ever belonged to because of some red line you can't cross.
Director Steve Pink was an unlikely candidate to make this movie. The Illinois native is the filmmaker behind Gross Point Blank, High Fidelity, and not one but two Hot Tub Time Machine movies. He's also a self-described liberal. Pink joins us to talk about The Last Republican. You're an Evanston native, a Hollywood director. Your politics are to the left. Why would you take on a project that centers a prominent Republican?
Yeah, I mean, well, I've always been a political junkie. And you're right to say that Adam Kinzinger was someone who I never thought I would make a film about. But the opportunity to make a political documentary about someone who stood up against Donald Trump and his own party in the wake of Jan 6 And for that, he lost his job. He lost many of his friends, his own family, or, you know, extended family members. Wrote a letter to the New York Times calling him a member of the devil's army. And so, you know, he was someone who, to me, was an incredibly compelling documentary subject.
Who do you think the audience is for this movie?
I think it's everyone. It's a profile of someone who sacrificed a great deal for what he believed in. And I think that's a relatable topic. It was always interesting to me that it's actually in his job description to uphold the Constitution. And so the fact that 140 Republicans decided to not uphold their oath is kind of shocking. And yet it just seems like something that everyone maybe not takes for granted exactly, but doesn't think is that big a deal. And Adam obviously thought that his oath to the country was a big deal. And I think that's a relatable thing. I think when somebody stands up for their truly held beliefs, I think that makes it a film that people in their own lives could see the importance and value of.
He calls you a communist, even, which I'm not sure you agreed with. Why did you leave that exchange in?
Well, I correct him immediately and say progressive, but sure. I left a lot of exchanges in that were a spirited back and forth between us. At the beginning of the film, he says, I think you have contempt for my views. Something that I don't disagree with, which was kind of my initial feeling. But then, you know, we go on to form a kind of friendship as I'm filming him go through the experience of his last year in Congress. And the movie kind of becomes a movie about the importance of civil discourse as a result.
In many ways, the documentary is a behind-the-scenes autopsy of the Select House Committee charged with investigating the January 6th Capitol riots. What surprised you most about that process? How does it show up on the film?
Well, we were just so lucky, and I'm so grateful that Benny Thompson, who is the chairman of the committee, allowed our camera into the hearing room, that we were the only camera besides the C-SPAN cameras to be able to capture what was going on in the room. And you could feel the stakes for everyone. That was something you don't necessarily get on TV. It's cut in a certain way. You're absorbing information as a TV audience viewer. But when you're in the room, it was palpable. It was striking.
You also show the blowback for Kinzinger's service on the special committee. It is swift. It is brutal. In the movie, we see staff and family dealing with these, you know, verbal threats, death threats.
Well, when the death threats began, it was hard for everyone to actually comprehend how serious it was. But as they increased and they increased in their ferocity and their scariness, everyone in the office, Adam Kinzinger's staff, and also Adam, had to take real precautions.
People are getting increasingly hostile
and a little more scary.
I hope somebody like him kills your nasty wife.
That one's going to Capitol Police.
Let's make sure that goes to district staff, too. Yeah.
I'm a pretty sensitive person.
We all have panic buttons under our desks.
Also didn't have a lot of experience, like, on the phone.
We had those checked, make sure they operate well. The Capitol Police came in at the beginning of the week, and they're like, we're going to check on you once every hour.
I think a lot of people don't realize how young a lot of congressional staffers are, and you show the emotional impact on these young people in this office. Why did you feel it was important to include that?
Well, when I was in the office and the camera was off, I would just talk to the staffers about whatever topic happened to be on our minds. And inevitably, the subject of the increasing danger to the office came up. And so I, you know, asked if it would be all right if I kind of captured their experience and how they felt about everything. And that's how I got those interviews.
The Last Republican aired at the Toronto and Chicago International Film Festivals. It's made the festival circuit, but it hasn't been picked up yet for wider release. It does seem like a shame that it's not more widely available right now as we're heading into Election Day.
Yeah, I think that's true on one level, but also I think that people are really, really busy. Even if the movie was out right now, I'm not entirely sure it would get the focus it deserves because the election is taking up everybody's energy and brain space and all that kind of thing. So, you know, it might be a crowded field in that way. And so I believe the movie will find its way to people. And when it does, I hope people embrace it.
Steve Pink is the director of The Last Republican. Thank you for talking with us, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
Statewide continues in just a moment. Stay here. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield is honoring the work of the Chicago sculptor Richard Hunt. Mawa Iqbal has more details.
Hunt was born on the South Side, just 2 blocks away from where Emmett Till grew up. Hunt was 19 years old when he witnessed Emmett Till's open casket funeral. His abstract interpretation of Till's head is the first piece visitors will see when walking into the exhibit. Curator Ross Stanton Jordan says Hunt was greatly impacted by Till's murder in 1955 and the subsequent civil rights movement.
And it really comes from him building a career out of finding ways to represent in abstract format the lives of people who were interested in freedom and expanding freedom.
The exhibit runs through April. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Election day is fast approaching, and a lot of people are at the end of their rope. Research shows an estimated 94 million Americans perceive politics as a significant source of stress. So what should you do to take care of your mental health during election season? Side Effects Public Media's community engagement specialist Lizzie McGreevy spoke with the health reporter Elizabeth Gabriel about that.
I've spoken with a few people, and they are capital S stressed about this election. Here's what Rachel, a woman in her 50s from Indianapolis, told me.
The constant barrage of negativity and fear-driven narratives was leaving me irritable, exhausted, and anxious. Politics was killing my soul, so I decided for my mental health to listen to more music and humorous podcasts like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on NPR.
That's actually a really good coping strategy. But yeah, I've heard a lot of people also feel similarly. This category of mental health is known as sociopolitical stress. It's become prevalent in people who are more politically active compared to people who aren't engaged in politics.
It's actually really helpful to know that this has a name. But can you tell us more? Like, for example, who is the most impacted by this sociopolitical stress and how is it affecting them?
Great question. So I spoke with Sara Suzuki, a researcher with the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement. In 2020, she tracked sociopolitical stress before, during, and after the election. The people who experience it the most are arguably impacted the most by politics.
LGBTQ plus youth, women. And in that specific research, we were starting to find a pattern of youth of color having those higher levels too.
Well, that seems to make a lot of sense. What are some of the signs and symptoms that one can expect to feel while experiencing sociopolitical stress?
There are many factors. Some of that looks like changes in sleep or appetite. Ruminating or looping thoughts that play over and over in your head are also an indication. That's something I'm guilty of. But therapist Laurel Roberts Meese says sociopolitical stress can exacerbate other mental health problems someone is already struggling with. Research shows that a little bit of stress and anxiety is actually good for the body, but too much can be bad.
We're going to start seeing more breakdown of tissue. We're going to see more neural networks that are not serving the person. We're going to see more trauma memories getting triggered, and chronic health conditions that are pre-existing are going to get worse.
That's why we have to be careful of how much we're taking on, which can look different for each person.
You know, Elizabeth, I thought I was eating a lot of Reese's Cups because it was Halloween season. Turns out it might just be my sociopolitical stress. So I will be sure to talk to my therapist about that. But I can't help but think not everyone has the luxury of just tuning out or to stop scrolling or thinking about politics. So for some people, political discourse may directly threaten their identity, their core beliefs, or even their ability to stay in our country. How do we juggle being engaged but also staying informed?
Therapists say checking with your news sources is really important, and signing up for newsletters could be a way to stay informed without being overwhelmed. They also talk about limiting the amount of time you spend on social media to make sure you aren't overexposing yourself to frustrating or disturbing content. that can lead to vicarious traumatization. Here's therapist Laurel Roberts Meese again.
You can be an activist and not just be constantly doom scrolling. In fact, you're going to have more capacity to be an activist if you're not constantly stressing yourself out.
On election night, therapists say it's okay to not watch the results come in. It's okay to do a puzzle or something more soothing to maintain your stress levels. Scheduling time to write out your worries about the election for about 20 or so minutes can be helpful too. Or put your phone in another room before you head to bed so you don't end up doom scrolling.
Sounds like it might be time to dust off the trusty old alarm clock and maybe some of those puzzles and board games for election night.
Yeah, that sounds very fun.
Health reporter Elizabeth Gabriel, she spoke with SideFX Public Media's Lizzie McGreevy. SideFX Public Media is a health reporting collaboration of NPR member stations across the Midwest. Well, this election season, Minnesota Public Radio News invited its audience to learn more about people on the other side of the political spectrum through an initiative called Walk a Mile in My News. Two of the participants, a Democrat and a Republican, swapped their go-to news sources, then allowed their conversations to be recorded. They had far more in common than they expected. Reporter Catherine Richard brings us this story.
Hi, Addie.
Lauren, can you hear me?
That's Lauren Bigler and Addie Rahm. They're meeting for the first time over Zoom.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. I can
At first blush, Rahm and Bigler couldn't be more different. Addie Rahm is a 20-year-old junior at St. Olaf College, and she considers herself a conservative. And Lauren Bigler is a 45-year-old corn and soybean farmer in southwestern Minnesota. She's a moderate liberal. But as Bigler starts to talk about her three kids, a common bond emerges.
We're doing cheer, we're doing volleyball, we're doing football. So I should also add, it's not a big deal, but it is that our oldest daughter, our 16-year-old, has Down syndrome.
My aunt has Down syndrome.
Rahm can relate.
I do Special Olympics in Northfield. I do the bowling. And my partner, Tanya, she's 50. She has Down syndrome. And we just have so much fun. So.
That makes me want to cry. I'm not going to cry.
That's just the first thing these two will find they have in common. They're also political outliers in their communities. Rahm says she's not winning any popularity contests being a conservative on a liberal college campus.
We've created a college environment where, like, if someone disagrees with you, you can report them for bias, or people should be scared to disagree with you because they might be racist. And that's often what I feel in class is... I actually dropped a class this semester because I just knew my voice wouldn't be acceptable there and I wouldn't be able to express my opinions. And so there's just this highly, highly political environment that takes up every aspect of your life.
And Lauren Bigler feels isolated in an area that supports former President Donald Trump.
I am second graders running around with Trump yard signs and like yelling things at people. And I'm only harping on that side because...
That's what you see. Yeah.
That is wholly what we see. My drive to and from school, I probably see 25 Trump yard signs. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's how red it is. So I find myself like wanting to do what I need to do and unengaging from people socially.
The connection Bigler and Rahm feel after one conversation kind of takes everyone by surprise.
I feel like we could have a good conversation about anything and still.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want you to be my daughter. I think you're sweet.
I'm like, oh my gosh, can I get your number? Can we get coffee? Like, would you listen to me?
But what will happen when they talk about specific news stories? Over the next several weeks, Rahm and Bigler send each other a bunch of links. Then they meet over Zoom again to discuss. Lauren Bigler, the left-leaning farmer, shares some traditional media sources, like an article from the Associated Press. And Addie Rahm, the conservative college student, chooses two podcasts from the Free Press, a right-leaning media outlet. Rahm's podcast choices throw Bigler off in kind of a big picture way.
This was harder than I thought it was going to be. I don't know if you felt that way.
Why did you think it was harder?
I guess it just made me think a little bit more about what I consider news. Maybe it's my age coming through. But when I think of news, I think about like... the major network stations. Like, it was interesting to me what you shared. I'm like, I would call this like an opinion piece.
Bigler says the pundits featured in the podcast were too emotional. And when news gets emotional, Bigler says she starts to think of it as advocacy. Rahm sees things differently.
All news is opinion, right? Like, all depending on how the New York Times writes the headline, it's pushing a different sort of bias. And so that's kind of reframed the way I think about news too, is in, and I'm not like a media conspiracist by any means, but we really can't trust what is being given to us. And it's all like being twisted some way. And so we have to be really careful and read a lot of different sources and find a way to make up our own minds instead of letting someone else, a journalist or someone, do the critical thinking for us.
But they agree that media and politicians that promote fear-mongering aren't great for democracy.
We need to just like stop that fear-mongering culture, because it makes this whole election more contentious than it needs to be. And it makes, and I also think politicians, like, they benefit from the fear-mongering, so they're not going to tell us to stop. So
you're saying everything I'm thinking, because they promise they're going to be everybody's savior.
Bigler says that as the election approaches, she's felt sad that so many people have lost sight of what they have in common. But talking to Rahm about the news has been a bright spot, because it's reminded her that common ground isn't so hard to find.
This has been more fun than I ever actually envisioned that it was going to be. It's been good for me. It's been good for me personally. And even though we didn't like share a ton of resources back and forth, just the idea of seeking out information somewhere else was really good for me. And I do wish you good luck during election season, from the standpoint of us both keeping our sanity.
Yeah, echoed. Yeah, thank you for indulging me on my rants. And I mean, I've had absolutely lovely time talking, getting to know you. And also, I've learned so much. And I feel like I understand people's perspectives much better after learning about yours and the area that you live. It's, it was great.
Catherine Richert, NPR News.
Illinois has a highly competitive congressional race this year that covers a large part of northwestern, western, and central Illinois. Alex Degman reports on the race for Illinois' 17th congressional district.
How much more do you have to go?
We're at a farm in Green Valley, just south of Pekin. Incumbent Democratic Congressman Eric Sorensen is chatting about the harvest as he gets ready to accept the endorsement of the Illinois Farm Bureau's Political Action Committee. Mike Deppert is president of the Tazewell County Farm Bureau.
He was one of only four Democrats to vote for the farm bill out of the House Ag Committee, and for that we're grateful. We need more bipartisan leadership, and Congressman Sorensen is exhibiting that.
Sorensen is in his first term. The freshman spent most of his career as a TV meteorologist in Rockford and the Quad Cities, and is the first openly gay U.S. representative from Illinois. Plus, he's the only meteorologist in Congress, and he says he's using that to start tough conversations with Republicans.
Maybe it's still behind closed doors that we can have agreements, but you know what? We're doing some pretty amazing things on the Space Science and Technology Committee that have to do with climate, where the Republicans have the majority in that committee. We're passing some really good legislation.
Democrats drew the current congressional map to put as many of their potential voters together as possible. You may have heard of that. It's called gerrymandering, and it happens every 10 years. Both parties do it, but Democrats have been in control here for decades. The 17th district includes some urban areas outside Chicago, like Rockford, the Quad Cities, and Peoria, plus parts of college towns like Galesburg, Macomb, and Bloomington Normal. Sorensen says his bipartisanship is his strength, given how large and diverse the district's needs are, but that size and diversity also make him vulnerable. Sorensen won his last election by just 4 points, and Republican Joe McGraw is trying to swing the district the other way. I caught up with McGraw after a rally in Rockford.
With the economy and the interest rates and the open border, Americans are struggling to survive, and they just can't make it.
McGraw is a former Illinois Circuit Court judge who retired after 20 years on the bench to run for Congress. While he didn't really talk about Donald Trump's campaign at this rally, McGraw does repeat some of Trump's campaign talking points, blaming the United States border policy for higher crime and more drug overdose deaths in the district, and arguing that inflation is making it more expensive for farmers to plant their crops. McGraw knows the district is drawn to favor Democrats, but he thinks Democrats are changing.
There's so many blue-collar folks there, union folks, African-American people, that are traditional Democratic voters. We've heard from them they're ready for a change. They don't feel secure, they don't feel safe, they don't feel prosperous, and they don't feel like the government is for them. They feel like they're an afterthought.
National observers also see a shift. Aaron Covey covers House races for Cook Political Report.
It is a relatively white working class district, which is, of course, a demographic that in the Trump era, Republicans have made significant gains with.
Cubby says CPR still gives the edge to Sorensen, though she says there are tighter races in other parts of the country that could determine the next Speaker of the U.S. House.
Illinois' 17th district is less competitive than a couple dozen other races that we have rated in more competitive categories, but it is still a race that is on the edge of the battleground, and so it's receiving national resources from both parties.
Sorensen has outraised and outspent McGraw by millions, making this one of the state's most expensive races. But for both parties trying to bolster their standing in Congress, it's Illinois' most consequential race. I'm Alex Degman.
And hopefully you get out to vote if you haven't done so already. Election Day is Tuesday. We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can find all of our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. Join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.